From Port Allegheny to Uniontown, Williamsport to Somerset, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, Governor Tom Wolf continues to reopen Pennsylvania at a pace slower than most other states. The impact on small business is great. David Taylor and Rebecca Euler are joined by Guy Shiraki from the Chester County Chamber of Business and Industry for a Capital Watch roundtable discussion. And a special commission is being formed to develop an alternative to the state's gasoline tax. I'll have a town hall commentary on why this is an opportunity to fundamentally reform transportation funding. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capital Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. As required by the U.S. Constitution, the process of redrawing Pennsylvania's congressional and legislative district lines will get underway when new census data is released in late summer. Republican leaders in the General Assembly have announced their appointments to the panel that will redraw district lines. State Senator Kim Ward of Westmoreland County and Representative Kerry Benninghoff of Center County will join Democratic Senator Jay Costa of Allegheny County and Joanna McClintock of Philadelphia, along with a fifth member who is supposed to be politically neutral. The redrawing of congressional district lines is a separate process and takes the form of a bill that must be passed by the legislature and signed by the governor. Due to slow population growth, Pennsylvania will lose one congressional district, complicating that process. Nearly 13,000 residents of Pennsylvania nursing homes have died during the COVID-19 pandemic, and that has triggered a formal State House investigation into the Wolf administration's handling of the situation. The House Government Oversight Committee will look into what extent Wolf's policies of sending COVID-19 positive patients back into nursing homes contributed to the high death toll. State Representative Jeff Pyle of Indiana County resigned this past week. He has been fighting cancer for a number of years and cited health problems as the reason for his resignation. Pyle was a popular member of the House. He was first elected in 2004 and authored a number of laws on topics ranging from the provision of emergency services to mine safety. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Governor Tom Wolf has announced the loosening of some COVID-19 restrictions on certain businesses in early April. But the pace of ending the draconian shutdown measures have been both slow and painful. Here to discuss the issue is our Capital Watch crew. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. Their special guest today, Guy Shiraki, who is president and CEO of the Chester County Chamber of Business and Industry. David?
And welcome once again to Capital Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, Rebecca Euler, president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. Rebecca, thanks for being here.
Great to be back again, Dave. Thank you.
Well, and there's a lot to talk about in that the governor and his emergency powers under the disaster declaration, that he renewed the disaster declaration, but the other day that he deigned to give us back some small sliver of our freedoms, at least temporarily. And anyway, I wanted to bring in our special guest, my friend Guy Shiraki, president and CEO of the Chester County Chamber of Commerce, to discuss this with us. Guy, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's an important topic, and it's important that we not only discuss it, but take away the lessons learned so it doesn't happen again.
Well, and that's exactly it. And, you know, the listeners on this show, Guy, have heard, you know, Rebecca and me and others talk about the damage that's been done, not just from the pandemic, but also from the lockdown. Of course, public health and public safety are paramount always, but our employers, in many instances, were denied the opportunity to operate at all, even if, you know, they didn't get the chance to adapt and improvise, and as a result, they were just shut down. And I mean, how are you seeing that reverberate down in southeastern Pennsylvania?
Well, thanks for the opportunity to discuss this. It's hard as we're now in month 13, in week 53 of what was 2 weeks to flatten the curve. We're all in this together. We were all going to sacrifice to help, and here we are 53 weeks later. Look, I think it's important to remember, without walking you and your listeners through the last year, week by week or day by day, to remember that this began with everything being closed, and then the idea that essential businesses would remain open. And Pennsylvania, unlike any other state, instead of using well-known, well-published guidelines, Governor Wolf tried to come up with his own definitions of essential business. It's a definition that we sit here 53 weeks later and we still don't know what the definition is.
Correct.
Some hardware stores were permitted to open. Some hardware stores were left closed. Some small businesses were allowed open. Others doing the same business were closed. So the impact continues to this day, and it continues in that we're all seeing friends, family, and neighbors who are either out of work or earning less money, but we're seeing that it continues to be unfair and not equally distributed in the sense that some folks have been able to adapt and been permitted to, and others not. I would say as you look today, even in Chester County, which often has the strongest county economy in the state, we're still seeing the effects here, particularly in the hospitality industry.
Right.
And in those sectors of the economy that it depend on all of us being out and about, you know, everything from buying gas to getting your car repaired, picking up a cup of coffee, or going to the dry cleaner. Those aspects of the economy that depend upon us going out and about and making spontaneous purchases, they're not happening. Those businesses are still hurting. Many of them are closed. Many of them don't have all their employees back, and we can see them even in a county like ours where the economy is usually strong.
I just wanted to add there, because you had talked about the definition of essential, I think. And going back and thinking back to last year at this time, I think the governor was using the term life-sustaining, I believe. And thinking back on that, it was that definition, or actually lack of a definition of life-sustaining, that was declared unconstitutional last year by a federal court in the Western District. And what one of the big reasons why they declared it unconstitutional is because it's arbitrary. Like you said, there wasn't any sort of sense of who was essential or what. It was inconsistent and arbitrary. And I sort of like to point to that, because I feel like that arbitrariness hasn't changed.
Yeah.
It's still arbitrary. We still have, even with the current order that just came out the other day and the guidelines that are in place, it still seems very arbitrary.
And
to
there's
me.
No science. No, there's no proof. I mean, again, I think people are
right.
are willing to. You know, we want to respect the authority. We want to have we want to address the public health crisis and all this stuff. But it just seems like they're making it up as they go, which is very dangerous.
Yeah. And Guy mentioned restaurants. I mean, for months and months, we asked for data about restaurants, and we finally got some of that data. And it was actually contrary to what, you know, the administration had said. Very few people who contracted COVID did it at you know, contracted it in a restaurant.
Yeah.
There was just very little data to support that, yet we're still left with the restaurant restrictions.
It's demoralizing to people trying to run a business, and it's entirely impractical. And you both, Rebecca and Dave, you both discussed it, and that is, it's the arbitrariness, but it goes a step further in that, because the governor's been granted this almost dictator-like power as the sole arbiter of what's open and closed, when and how, there has been this lack of engagement, this lack of reaching out, the lack of dialogue. So even there are times where we all have to deal with regulations that we find unfair or unruly. There's usually a system of checks and balances, a system of transparency where a rule is put forth. The people in the affected industry know the rule is coming. You have a chance to debate it, try to improve it, and then before it's put in effect. Here, these decisions are made with no notice.
Correct.
They often take effect within 24 hours and only could be put in place by people in government who seem to have no understanding of how the private sector works. Go back to last December, when restaurants were told on Thursday afternoon that Friday they were closing. For the foreseeable future, we'll get back to you in 2021. To not understand that restaurants, catering halls, event venues had called in staff, set up schedules, purchased food, purchased drinks, in some cases perhaps hired music or support or parkers or whatever, you know, valet folks.
Yeah.
And to just come out at in the middle of the afternoon on Thursday and announce they're closing Friday, that's only done when you have no understanding of what of how the private sector works. We understand because of what the governor said that things are about to theoretically loosen up come April 4th. But candidly, none of us know why they're going to get better April 4th.
Right.
We have no idea how long they'll stay that way and when they may improve or worsen. Again, you cannot operate a business at full capacity, pay your workers, do business with your vendors when you have absolutely no ability to predict and plan. And that whole aspect has been utterly ignored for the last 13 months.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that order for restaurants in December was the second time that had happened. It also had happened earlier in the year when restaurants were ordered closed at the very last minute, and even the first time it happened, we heard an outcry from restaurant owners about how that's impractical and should not happen, and then yet again it had happened again, which makes your point about you know, transparency and actually talking to the folks who are involved in these decisions.
Yeah, and the real fatal conceit here is the is presupposing the omnicompetence of government. When we knew, going back to the outbreak of the pandemic, that eventually there would be a vaccine, and that the urgent priority at that moment in time when the vaccine became available would be a system of inoculation so that people could get their shots and as a result be resistant to the infection. Well, we've seen just the most catastrophic rollout of vaccinations in Pennsylvania. And now that the governor did step in and use his power and bring in the National Guard to inoculate school staff. So you're going to have, you know, 30-year-old teachers getting their shots before, you know, 88-year-old senior citizens. I mean, that to me is, again, one more example of hubris where the governor and his senior staff and whoever else is around him who were making these decisions, that they're disconnected from reality, in my opinion.
And it's like you said, Dave, and Guy pointed out that there's no transparency. There's no requirement that the governor actually talk to anybody during this dictatorial sort of period. Regulations, like Guy said, go through a transparency process. They have to be published. They have to be debated. There's a public comment period. The legislature is involved. All of those things. And you would learn through that process what some of the problems are with these, you know, policies, but that is not happening.
Because he's been siloed off and allowed to be given these extraordinary powers, in essence, by the Supreme Court, our legislature's been irrelevant. So you have all of these elected officials and their staffs that live in communities from all four corners of Pennsylvania that are talking to business people, school directors, teachers, nonprofit directors that have that wealth of information of real life experience with no real ability to convey that experience back to as they would normally in crafting legislation or regulation. And David, as you pointed out, it's the same thing in the vaccines. I mean, in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, where the biopharma industry is one of our sectors that we otherwise would market and trumpet and people will go and cut ribbons and give proclamations. But here we sit with one of, you know, probably the top 10 states in terms of having biopharmaceutical companies.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
With AmerisourceBergen that has been boxing and shipping and delivering medication to the four corners of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And no one in the governor's office has ever picked up at the phone and said, could we get some advice on how to ship vaccines? Could we get some advice on how to move medicine? Mm-hmm. As you said, the hubris and the lack of transparency extended not only to the regulations and the lockdowns, but we're seeing it on display, sadly, in this issue of vaccines. We have a registration website that with all due respect, you know, our vaccine registration site, if that was a school project given to high school students at a STEM academy, they would have put together a better one over lunch. But I think the connecting theme to all this is that the governor has been detached. He's had no incentive to engage with folks, and as a result, all of this stuff is put together from on high with no real-world implications, and that's why it needs to be changed.
You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers, Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association, and our special guest, Guy Shiraki, President and CEO of the Chester County Chamber of Business and Industry. So the good news for our listeners is that there is a way out, that the General Assembly has passed in two consecutive sessions a constitutional amendment that would rein in these emergency powers, and if enacted, that the governor would have an emergency declaration that could last for 21 days, after which the consent of the General Assembly would be necessary to continue that declaration. And this will be on the ballot in the primary election here in 2021.
Right. And it also would not allow the governor to veto that declaration, which also is important since he did veto the one that passed last year.
Yeah, so, which is madness, which was just a complete corruption by the state Supreme Court. For all of us who work in the legislative, in and around the legislative process, the key distinction is between may and shall.
Right.
That may means that, yes, the government has this power and can choose to exercise it if it wishes. Shall means that's the thing you absolutely have to do, and that the Supreme Court's read that shall meant may, and this is why we're in the mess we're in.
Well, like you said, the good news is there is a way out, but right now it is dependent on the voters of Pennsylvania
mm-hmm.
to get out on May 18th and vote yes
vote
on these
yes.
two amendments. Yes. Now, there is some confusion.
Would say chicanery.
Right. If you actually were to read the wording of the constitutional amendment that's going to appear on the ballot, which was drafted by the Department of State under the Wolf administration, it is confusing, to say the least.
Yeah, and deliberately so. It's a deliberate
right.
misrepresentation.
Yeah. So it actually references removing existing checks and balances in the wording, which I think is just completely egregious, because
yeah.
the whole purpose of the constitutional amendment
is to establish.
Yes.
Establish
yes.
checks and balances.
That's the idea. So to actually have it say that it's removing checks and balances, I think, is just incredible. But I meant it's meant to confuse, it's meant to deceive, and I think we must make it clear to the voters out there that they must vote yes on these two amendments.
Stop Wolf, vote yes.
It's interesting you say it. So, sort of a precursor, my next column in Broaden Liberty, which is an online journal I've been writing in, my next column is exactly on this topic.
Oh, perfect.
And, God.
The timing, everyone will think that we've synced this up perfectly, so kudos.
But share your thoughts, please.
It's amazing because, again, this is, as I say, in over a cup of coffee or in an elevator ride, two regular people could explain what we're trying to do very easily. The legislature simply passed a piece of legislation, which is Senate Bill 2, and anyone can look it up on their phone or computer or tablet. But the bill simply says that the governor may impose emergency orders, and they may last up to 21 days. If the governor believes that the emergency orders regulating our life, our travel, our health, our education, or regulating anything through emergency powers, if that needs to go beyond 21 days, the governor needs a majority of the legislature to agree. It's not very complicated. It's common sense. It's straightforward. Only in government could a simple idea that you could read in a piece of legislation over several lines be turned into two 60-word questions with phrases, commas, dashes, dots, and citations to put you to sleep with, as you said, you both alluded to, is misleading language.
Yeah, the technical term is baffle-gab.
Yes, I like that. If they had thought of it, they would have put it in the actual question.
It's possible.
So the message to everyone is to vote yes on the ballot questions on May 18th, and whether you vote by mail ahead of time and show up, and you vote by paper, pen, or touchscreen, the ballot questions are at the end. They're usually things that we forget about or are lower priority. I would say, with all due respect, these questions are every bit as important, if not more important, than anything that it will be on the ballot in the primary. We must vote yes on both questions. And if you do that, if we are successful, we actually just restore things back to the way we all understood democracy to be, which is the governor works with the legislature to set rules and standards that we're asked to live by. The rules and legislation would be debated in public. We would understand how they're being imposed. It would all be transparent and all be above board, and we'd understand no more dictatorship. that seems fairly reasonable. The next time, heaven forbid, there's an emergency, the governor has 21 days to take the steps he or she needs to make things right. You want to go beyond 21 days, you need the legislature. It is necessary to do because the governor has acted alone and because the Supreme Court said he could. So this is an attempt to set things right and to set it back the way all of us thought that a democracy was supposed to work.
Yes, sir. Exactly right on all counts.
I think it's really important to point out, too, that this is not a partisan issue. This is an issue, like you said, Guy, of setting things right again and setting a balance of power between the two, the executive and the legislature. So it doesn't matter whether the governor is a Democrat or a Republican. It's too much power in the hands of one person.
And this
person.
Is for voters in the primary. It'll appear on the Democrat ballot, on the Republican ballot. If you are a voter, you'll be asked these questions. So as ever, we need people to exercise their citizenship and live life with their brains turned on. So that is all the time we have for this program, but especially want to thank Guy Shiraki from the Chester County Chamber of Business and Industry. Guy, where can people go to learn more about you and your organization and the things that you do?
Thanks very much. I appreciate this opportunity. I would encourage folks, whether you're in Chester County, in the Delaware Valley, or across the state, we'll be there to be a resource to help. You can find us anywhere on social media at Chesco Chamber and on the internet at cccbi.org. That's the Chester County Chamber of Business and Industry, cccbi.org, or on social media at Chesco Chamber. Thanks again.
Outstanding. Rebecca, where can people find you and your organization?
They can find the my organization at www.pmta.org.
Outstanding. And as ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org and on Sunday mornings at 8:30 on the Pennsylvania Cable Network with PMA Perspective. So from Rebecca and Guy and me, thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. It is a law of nature that bureaucracies and government agencies always crave a larger share of the public treasury. In Pennsylvania, the undisputed leader of the pack is the public education establishment, which has a voracious and insatiable appetite for taxpayer dollars. A close second is the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation, or PennDOT, which is always clamoring for more money, much more money. The public education and transportation behemoths have two traits in common. No matter how much their budgets are increased, it is never enough. And neither shows any significant improvement in performance resulting from constant funding increases. PennDOT kicked up the most recent funding controversy by floating a plan to place tolls on several major bridges in the Commonwealth, supposedly to maintain and upgrade the structures. Predictably, the idea has been met with stiff opposition from commuters and the potentially affected industries. Governor Tom Wolf has never met a tax he doesn't like. Until now. He is impaneling a special commission to develop a plan to replace the state's gasoline tax with a new funding scheme. The increased fuel efficiency of gas-powered vehicles, coupled with a trendy push for electric cars, threaten to drive the gas tax revenue downward. The goal of the commission, of course, is to increase the flow of funding into PennDOT's coffers. At 58.1 cents per gallon, Pennsylvania's gas tax is the second highest in the nation, only behind California. Just a few years ago, in 2013, higher taxes were levied on producers, the practical impact of which was to add about 30 cents per gallon to the price of gasoline for a cumulative hit of over $2 billion per year to motorists. Now the agency is claiming it needs an additional $7 billion to maintain the state's roads and bridges. For decades, successive governors and legislatures have slapped Band-Aids on Pennsylvania's transportation funding formula. That approach has had a particularly negative effect on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, which is a separate agency. In 2007, a law went into effect that has siphoned hundreds of millions of dollars from Turnpike coffers into PennDOT, some of which the commission has had to borrow. That, in turn, has triggered steep annual increases in turnpike tolls, more than doubling fares over that time frame. The labyrinth that is state transportation funding is further complicated by the continued financial drain caused by public transportation. Both PennDOT and a portion of those turnpike dollars subsidize public transit systems. The biggest, the Southeastern Pennsylvania Transportation Authority, SEPTA, in the Philadelphia region, and Port Authority Transit, PAT, in Pittsburgh, are bloated, inefficient, and inept bureaucracies that have been resistant to reform due to union-driven political pressures. Against this backdrop, Governor Wolf has ordered establishment of a special commission to develop recommendation for changes to the current system of transportation funding. In a departure from his usual go-it-alone approach to governing, Wolf seeks to include legislators and transportation industry representatives on the commission. This, however, should be viewed with great suspicion. The commission's charge is to find a way to eliminate the gas tax and find funding alternatives with a goal of adding billions of dollars to the transportation budget. It is indeed time for the development of a comprehensive restructuring of transportation funding, but just throwing more money into the pot will not solve the problem. Also needed is a streamlining and restructuring of the entire array of transportation entities operating in the state, beginning with the Department of Transportation and the Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission, and extending to the regional public transportation agencies. The system is beset with administrative bloat, funding inequities, and antiquated labor contracts. There is universal agreement that roads and bridges, public transit, railroads, and airports are vitally important to the economic vibrancy of Penn's Woods. Rather than take the political difficult but necessary step of developing the comprehensive plan needed to knit all of the above together, state policymakers have taken the easy way out by just throwing money at whatever crisis happens to develop. This is a unique opportunity to systematically address Pennsylvania's transportation needs. Hopefully, the governor's commission doesn't turn into yet another way to simply suck more money out of taxpayer wallets, but rather takes the first steps toward developing a sustainable transportation system. With a town hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. And it is time to begin talking about the 2021 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference. After being virtual last year, an in-person conference will be held June 11 and 12 at the Radisson Penn Harris Convention Center in Camp Hill. The Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is the premier gathering of conservative activists each year here in the Keystone State. This year's featured speakers include Jesse Waters, host of Waters World on the Fox News Channel, Fox News contributor Jason Chaffetz, along with John Gizzi of Newsmax. Complete information and registration for the 2021 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference can be found at paleadershipconference.org. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, lincolnradiojournal.com and lincolninstitute.org. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.